Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's had a shit against a wall 50 yards from his own front door. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much. Lovely to be here. I tell you, you missed home. You missed quite a warm-up. You're going to wish... I don't think there'll be any laughter left in this room after the blazing trail I did in the first half. Sometimes when you've done a great show, you want to thank every member of the audience individually. Tonight that will be possible. But welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or as all the cool kids are calling it, Rahalastapur. I can't do it. As Chortle are calling it, Rahuspa. They've missed out the T because they're not cool. It's a stupid weekly chat show podcast. It's doing very well. It's been at the top of the iTunes charts. It's been quite a week. Been an amazing weekend of football once again. York City won the Blue Square Premier playoff. That's what everyone's talking about. I tell you, it's been an amazing week to be... I've supported York City for 30 years. I was born near York. People ask because I'm from Somerset, but I was born in Yorkshire. Nothing has happened except loss in all that time. This week, we've won 2 tournaments at Wembley in 8 days. I don't really know how to react. I'm feeling a bit bamboozled. I don't actually like it. I only support them because they're shit. And I don't like football. But now I've kind of got sucked into it. I was crying yesterday. It's character building. All those people who support Chelsea. Oh, yeah, is that you? You don't understand why support teams that's always going to win, that they've paid loads of money and they're going to win. You want to support York City and then 30 years and then they suddenly win and it's fucking mind-blowing.
So anyway, they're going to be playing league football. I hope you will all follow them next year. York City. So that was very, very exciting news for me. And it got me. I had a dream about York the day before that I was playing for York City, which has become my default dream now. I've never been good at sport, certainly playing football. Like my old dream used to be doing my maths A level again, even though I was in my 30s or 40s, having to go back and sit in my maths A level. Sometimes doing a play and had not been given the script. But now it's that I'm watching York City and then have to go on and play for them. And I'm seriously pretty good. But in my dream, we got 3-0 up in the first half, then we lost 4-3 in the second. So it's such a toss-up. But it reminded me of being at school. It's weird that I can still remember arguments from being when you're 8 years old. I don't know if everyone can do this. But when I was 10 at school, at Fairlands Middle School in Cheddar, I had a serious argument with another guy who was in my year, like a 10-year-old child, who said he was really good at football. He said if the Fairlands under-10 side were to play Liverpool FC, who were the best team in the country at that point, the adult team, that if they were played 100 times, Fairlands would win one time out of 100. I said that wouldn't happen. I said if Liverpool played a team of 10-year-olds and were told they had to try, you know, that they wouldn't. There was no way. If they played like a million times, I think they would still win a million times. This is. I'm presuming it's still the same thing. The squad is changing. I'm not sure Liverpool would go for even playing them once. I think it'd be a waste. If Liverpool were saying, right, we're going to play this team a million times, well, won't that impinge on our actual professional fixtures? Doesn't matter, we're going to do it. I think if they played a billion times, maybe one time they'd get hit by an asteroid or something. And the Fairlands Middle School would win. But I remember this, what were you saying over there? Chipping in? What?
Squillion.
Squillion times. Yeah, well, thanks. I wasn't sure where we went after a billion, but thank God. Thank God you were here to. If it was a squillion times, Fairlands would win, I think. Just because that isn't a number. But of course, if you played a billion times, also you'll get to a point where the Liverpool side were quite old. And they'd be kind of in their 90s and they might be dead. And then Fairlands might be able to beat them. But I remember that argument, so I was right. I think I was definitely right. And this guy wouldn't. I can't remember who it was, but I hope he's listening. But I had another argument when I was 10 with my friend Phil Fry, who's still one of my best friends now. When we were 10 years, he was quite skinny and I was a little bit chubby. I know, you know, it's hard to believe. I've slimmed down a lot since then. And don't look like that. He said if there was a famine or we were on like a desert island or something, that he would last longer than me. I said I would last longer because I had the reserves of fat to keep me going. And he said he would last longer because he was thin. He would get by without so much food. I would need food. I think he was wrong about that. But I'm still not sure. At the time, I wasn't sure if he was right, but I'm still not sure. But it's good. I don't know if anyone else has those, where they keep them going. I might ask Charlie if he's got any of those to keep him going. And the big news this week was Derek Acora, or Acura, has got into trouble because... And this interests me because he said that he's been speaking to someone from the spirit world, not Madeline McCann herself. She's kept tight-lipped. He has. What? You're making up your own jokes? He says, there's no joking, there's nothing disgusting in that. She's kind of quiet. The source from the other side said, Madeline McCann is not on this earth anymore. Right? And people are upset about that because they think it's sick that Derek Acora. Is making this claim. It's kind of an odd thing to do if you have that channel to the other world and you find out that a child's dead. Probably the most sensitive way to let the parents know isn't to announce in a national newspaper. If I had that, I probably would ring them and go, I've got some bad news for you. It's kind of an oddly worded thing. That's what I don't get about it. It's that Madeline McCann is not on this earth anymore. And if she was dead, you could just say she's dead. And that's what he's interpreted as, but it seems to me that Madeline McCann has been abducted by aliens. That is the... Why would the spirit talk in this kind of odd... She's not on this earth anymore. She must be... So that's kind of... But people got very cross with it. But that's what his job is. His job is to say horrible things to emotionally vulnerable people. So it's kind of... it's kind of odd that people have got upset about it. Oh no, now that's gone too far. Now he's talked about a famous, possibly dead person. Now we can't have that anymore. But you know, if you can speak to the dead, which you can, I talk to the dead all the time. Thing is, they don't talk back to me. They just stay silent when I'm talking to them. But you can, you know, if you could. You could find out some amazing things. All these people do, these mediums, is to find out things that you already know and the first letters of the names of people you know. I already know the first letters of the names of the people. If I had a channel to the other world, and look, they can say a whole sentence is not on this earth anymore. That's at least 17 letters. There's three or four words. You could get some good information from them, even if it's a bit jarring, even if you have to kind of do charades every now and again. You could find, my first question, which religion is correct? That's the first thing. What kind of heaven are you in? Is it which? Have a look. Who is God? Let me know. That's the first thing you ask, right? And secondly, you know, where is some pirate treasure hidden? That'd be second. I'd want to know some proper. The fact they can only tell you things you already know, that makes, even if it's possible to do it, it makes their service useless. So I don't. He's obviously a twat anyway, but. Not the point, so anyway, but Mark Zuckerberg, is that his name? Zuckerberg, anyway, from off of the Facebook. I call it the Facebook still, I think that was a better name for it. I think that bloke from NSYNC was wrong. Told him to take it off, I think that was a mistake. I think it would be worth about 500 billion if it was the Facebook. Anyway, he's lost £1.8 billion today. Yeah, he's only got like 20. I don't even know how many is it. It's 100 billion, wasn't it? He was worth. I think that's too much money, 100 billion. I think if you've made 100 billion pounds or dollars, probably time to retire, I would say. There's a point where you go, I think that'll probably see me through. I'll just cash these. I'll cash these in now. What are you waiting for? I'm just another 100 billion, then I'll just be secure. It's not like he spends any money on clothes or anything. It's not. If you've seen him, he's got no interest. He's got married as well, so copying me. But I'm kind of hoping, you know, I've started a kind of free, because he did it all for free to begin with. I'm a very astute businessman. Mark. Is it Mark Zuckerberg? Is his name Mark? I want to call him Mark. Yeah, it is good. Alan Zuckerberg. Yeah, good. A little cross reference there. You know, we're having fun, aren't we? We're having fun then. We're having fun. Then. People at home don't look at what I wonder. Like, say that, it's stupid. But anyway, I'm hoping that this, if you all want to buy shares now, sell your shares at £38 a share. Just the people in this room, I'll take that. To be honest, if you the 100 people in here will give me £38 each, I'll just quit now and retire with that. I reckon I could live off that. That's quite a lot. We've got an economics postgraduate and a near graduate. Graduand, I think you are. No, you haven't. You're not even a graduand. I'm a graduand. Sarah here in the front row, bit of a busybody, know-it-all. She's waiting for her degrees to come through in economics. What's 38 times 100?
380.
380. I'm not so sure the confidence in the degree is justified. You don't do maths. I think that might be a problem with your economics degree there. Is it more like describing... What does economics mean in the David Copperfields? Is that what you were doing? Describe the economy of the old curiosity shop. Well, that's good, Dylan. It's nice to... Any luck in the interval, Mark, Alan and Sarah? Joy, in fact?
Joy.
May.
May. I can't be expected to remember everything. It's my wife's middle name, Joy. That's why I got into... Going to that, I sort of just started imagining you were my wife. You know, within the bounds, it's all I'm allowed to do now, but within the bounds of this podcast, actually, I've made an arrangement with my wife that, admittedly, she only heard back when I mentioned it last week. I don't think she ever listened to the Edinburgh Fringe podcast. I've imagined an arrangement with my wife where I'm allowed to have sex with whoever I want during the podcast, during the actual recording. So if you fancy hopping up, we can give that a go, and that is all right. Then I will still remain married. But I'm married now, so aside from that, May, who was born in January. Yeah. Now, apparently that makes me racist. So, But anyway, look, I think we'll probably get on with stuff. I think, again, once again, whipped everyone up. Will you please welcome? I'm very proud to have this guest. He's a Chortle Internet Comedy nominee. which I won it. And amazing, he's a renaissance man. There's a lot of things to talk about. Will you please welcome the incredible Charlie Hickson, ladies and gentlemen? Here he comes. He's both here. Are you drinking Foster's beer there? Is that, are you allowed to drink?
Funnily enough, I do actually like Foster's beer.
I do like
quite a little bit because it's not too strong.
That's good, yeah.
Well, because you see, I grew up, I'm quite old, in the days when beer wasn't very strong. And you would know how many pints of beer you could drink of an evening.
Yes.
I don't want to get absolutely smashed out of my head. I enjoy drinking beer. And with lager nowadays, it's too strong.
Right. This isn't a great advert for Foster's. I'm not sure they'll be delighted. The great thing about Foster's is it's weak as piss. You can drink
When Foster's first came over here,
yeah,
it was probably the strongest lager you could get. Mm. And I've stuck with it in the middle there. And the rest of the lager's gone way over the top.
But well, let's talk about your short to losing podcast. Oh, first of all.
No, I wondered who'd won that.
No one else but me. I've won it two years running. I'm like the York City of the internet.
What was it you won it for?
This year, just for generally being brilliant on the internet. Last year, better than everything else on the internet, including the Facebook. And last year, for As It Occurs to Me, but you weren't up again. But I beat the Fosters, surprisingly. I mean, I wasn't surprised about the Fast Show, but beating Alan Partridge was a surprise.
No, I mean, the only consolation for me in it is that Fosters paid us huge amounts of money.
Yeah. I'm not. I'm playing the long game. Come back in 20 years' time, I'll be worth $100 billion. This month, I'll be sitting here on a bed of $100 billion. I'll have changed. Every seat would just be made out of dollars. The stage would be made out. I won't be able to spend. What would you do if you had $100 billion? I mean, you are quite successful. Could you spend $100 million?
The problem is, no matter how much money you've got, you always want more. There's always going to be someone.
Not
you move up
million.
Into an. He, you see, Mark Zuckerberg now is probably mixing with all these Bill Gates. I think, oh, I wish I had as much money as Bill. He can buy a whole country.
What would you do with it? What would you do?
With a country?
Yeah.
Would you ruin it? You'd have a laugh, wouldn't you? It's my country. I'll do what I like.
Would you make your own laws?
Yeah.
Which laws would you abolish?
Well, I hadn't really thought it through that. I only just come up now.
You seem very excited. That's all when it came up, I thought, there's a man who's got this planned out. He thought, when I'm making my first $100 million.
I'll get them to make a cheese and name it after me.
Ambition. I could probably make that happen for America. Through this podcast, I can probably get someone to name a cheese, the Charlie Hickson cheese. I know a lot of people in cheddar, for a start. So
I don't want an already existing cheese just renamed.
Rename cheddar Charlie Hickson. That's not going to happen.
Well, if you
I mean the Charlie Hickson cheddar.
If you owned England, you could do that. You can change cheddar to be Charlie Hickson cheese.
If there are any cheesemakers out there listening, let's just check there's no one in. I mean, there's quite a lot of people here. There probably is someone. If you have money, they actually can make cheese. Just someone involved. Anyone involved in dairy products generally. That surprises me, but hopefully someone. Maybe someone, if anyone wants to name a cheese, Charlie Hickson cheese, and then maybe a Richard Herring cheese, then maybe we can have an award for the best of
the
those
best cheese.
The best cheese named after a 1990s TV.
You could win for a cheese that, you know, connoisseurs like, but nobody buys much, and I could win a big mass market cheese that loads of people buy, like cheddar.
It's sad. I'm happy with that. So you are born in Somerset. Did you grow up in Somerset?
No, I remember nothing of it. I was born there, and my father moved around a lot for his work.
Sorry, I was going to say something awful, and then I thought, I bet you're not Andrew Collins, so I won't go there. What did your dad do?
He was a serial killer.
That's what you were going to say.
He was an accountant.
A travelling accountant.
Look, it's not an interesting anecdote.
Why was he moving?
Well, because he would get attached to a company, he'd have to go and work for them, and then he'd get attached to another company and go work for them.
Would he know what 380 times 100 was?
Yeah, 3,800.
Yeah, he's good.
He's passed down. There is nothing funny to say about it, but I mean, I must warn you before we proceed too far that I am a notoriously boring interviewee.
I wasn't expecting cheese to come up so soon. Cheese will probably come up somewhere, but not straight away.
Jonathan Ross did once, actually, and this is absolutely true, he fell asleep whilst interviewing me. It's a true story. He did this programme, it was a kind of entertainment programme for in-flight TV, I think it was for Virgin or something like that. And they did all these pre-recorded interviews, and it was a kind of entertainment show, and it was interviewing me about what I did. And it was done in, you know, when you watch all those list programs, and you see people being interviewed, you think, well, they've got a nice house, or I wonder where that is. It's all filmed in, like, hotels and clubs and restaurants around London.
Yeah.
And this was in the basement of this sort of fancy Turkish restaurant. It was quite a warm day. He'd been there a long time, and he apologised before he started. He said, well, I'm sorry, Charlie, a bit hungover, And we started talking, and I've got this habit in interviews where I stupidly answer the question that's asked.
Yeah.
Which, and you know that interviews actually just, you're trying to prompt someone to just say something funny and do impressions or something. So I would give long, involved answers. And we were halfway through this interview, and he asked me this question, and I was giving this long, involved answer, and I looked over at him, and he was doing this kind of comedy falling asleep face. You know, he was all drooped down like this, his mouth hanging open. And I said, oh, yes, oh, very funny, John. Yes, it was a slightly long anecdote. And then I realised he had actually fallen asleep. He was fast asleep in the chair. And then he woke up, oh, God, I'm really sorry, Charlie. And I don't know who that reflects worse on, him or me. Me, probably.
He was tired, I'm a little bit tired, so we'll see how it goes. He told me when he was interviewing Barbara Windsor that he was so bored that he couldn't give another question, and he had to pretend he'd lost his contact lens. That was the only way So you did quite, I think that's better, to fall asleep is better.
Well, it was.
That might be just his way of getting out, I can't think of another. I'm going to try that. If I can't think of another question for you, I'm going to try falling
but
asleep.
But I mean, he did look like, as I say, he was doing a sort of comedy. It was such an exaggerated sleep face he had. But no, it was real.
So you don't remember anything about Froome, where Froome. You were born?
Well, no, I mean, funnily enough, one of my brothers now lives there.
Oh.
I don't know why I said funnily enough, because it wasn't funny, was it?
Sorry, this is a nice
point. I mainly grew up in Sussex and Kent, funnily enough. There's nothing funny about my childhood. I had a very, very ordinary, boring childhood.
You had four.
Thank God.
Three brothers, is that right? You had three brothers?
You're not going to get a funny anecdote about that.
I'm not expecting
I've got three brothers.
You're the third of four. Three out of four.
Yes.
How's that being the second last child? Is that why you became a comedian? Everyone's got theories about the first, second. I've not had four kids. It's quite a lot, though, isn't it? And four boys.
Four boys. Yes.
Were you kind of bullied by your older brothers?
No.
Which one lives in the room? The older or the younger one?
Number two.
So that's a typical number two child going back. Was he born in Froome? He thought, I better return to like a spawning trout.
I don't know where he was born because my father moved around a lot. I obviously wasn't there. I wasn't even born. How would I know where he was born? Why are we talking about
this? I don't know where my brothers. My dad moved around a lot as well.
Yeah.
Keith
Haring. Where all your brothers were born?
My brother was born in Halifax. Right. My sister was born somewhere. I don't know where my sister was born. That's blown my mind. Maybe she wasn't born. Maybe she kind of was hatched out of a pod. Why would I know where my brother was from and not my sister? It's like my parents. Maybe she's adopted. God, I hope she is. I hope my nephews and nieces are listening to this, and that's the first, won't be the first revelation I've accidentally given them about my sister, assuming they knew it already. Good. I was going to have a kind of Somerset off with you, because actually I wasn't born in Somerset. I was born in Yorkshire, hence that was born in York City. And then my trendy serial killing rapist father moved to working in different schools, moved down the country to Leicestershire and then to Cheddar, funnily enough.
To Cheddar. Yeah. No, I can't. I've got nothing to say about it. I mean, I like Somerset. It's a very nice country, and I think, you know, West Country people are unfairly maligned. They're no more stupid than anyone else.
A bit more stupid. So there's loads of stuff to talk about, because you have done millions of thousands of things in your life. You've done squillions of things, I think would be the best way of looking at it. And I was looking at your... And I do vaguely remember the Hicksons from back in the 1980s, but I've been revisiting. You're a proper pop star.
I was a pop singer, yes.
Sort of, you're a punk sort of.
Well, it was punk funk we did.
Yeah.
It was a sort of forgotten movement of the early 80s. Well, Pigbag are probably the best known proponents. They had a hit.
Alan Thomas, Alan 99 T. from Twitter, asked, yes. Someone had stole my copy of Conspiracy. Do you have any spare ones under your bed? Is what he asked.
I think I've only got the one copy.
Have you?
But you can, I think you can download it now.
Ah, that's not as much fun.
It's not much fun.
Did you ever find out who stole your bongos?
No, you see, it was a lyric from a song. It wasn't real.
I assumed you had written it from life.
No, you see, that what people don't understand is that most song lyrics are just made up stuff. And they're not all real.
Okay.
So, I had a song where the chorus was, "Who stole my bongos?"
A good song.
Yeah.
Have a listen. Seriously, let's try and get back to number one. I can do that for you. only because you don't really have to sell many records to get to number one now. Everyone at home, go and buy Conspiracy if it's there on iTunes.
Our highest chart position was 72.
Was it?
Yeah. With a cover version of an Andy Williams song, Music to Watch Girls.
Yes, I heard that. I was listening to that one today.
But we still sold more records than the current number one. But no, it was a fantastic thing to do. I mean, you know, I did it straight out of university, and I was a singer for 6 years, and that's how I made my living, by singing.
But that's incredible. Like, you're a proper rock star, and you're called Switch.
I was called Switch.
Did you actually, like, was it like Bono and you insisted, was it like the Edge?
No, what happened was, as I was saying, I had a fairly normal, boring childhood, and I was at school. My main schooling was in Sevenoaks in Kent, commuted country. And I was off to university, and I thought, I want to become a more interesting and exciting person. So I made up a nickname for myself and bleached my hair, and I turned up at university dressed as a punk, a student punk from Sevenoaks. And people would say, "Oh, hello, you know, what's your name?" And I'd say, "Switch." Expect them to say, "No, you fucking not. You're Charlie Hickson." I said, "No, I'm Switch." And nobody batted up the eyelids. Go, "Oh, right. Oh, hello, Switch." And everybody called me. So it was brilliant. It's fantastic. You can go to university. You can completely reinvent yourself and make yourself up as a new person. So I became Switch, the punk singer.
If you'd been like a massively popular star, that would have been your name for the rest of your
life. Funnily enough, I've got to stop saying that and then having a very dull anecdote. My wife still calls me Switch.
Does she?
When she's angry. Yeah, so, but no, people just called me Switch for years until, funnily enough, my family called me Murray.
Okay.
When I was growing up, I was called Murray.
So why, it's your middle name?
No.
No?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is.
But my father, being an accountant, he wanted us properly organised, so...
Yeah, it'd be in alphabetical order.
Yes. My eldest brother's called Andrew. My second brother's Barney.
Yeah.
I was Charles, and then Daniel was the fourth one. So we were in alphabetical order, so he couldn't get us muddled up.
He was hoping for more kids, wasn't he? He had it all planned out.
Edward, Fred, George, Harry, they were all lined up. But, you know, that way he couldn't get confused and could always keep us organised. But he didn't actually like the name Charles. So he called me Murray.
Couldn't he have got a different name to give me? Why did he name you and name
I've got no idea, but they all called me Murray. So then I went to university and called myself Switch.
That's cool.
And then over the years, the guys in the band, because all musicians in a band automatically hate the singer. They all think, that cunt at the front. Poncing about, I should be there in that position doing that. I should be the famous one. And when they come and do interviews, they always want to talk to the singer.
Yes, of course.
I mean, I was the most interesting one in the band, but... but no, and so when they found out that
And it was called the Hicksons, that must have fucking annoyed them.
Well, I didn't make it.
Was it all your brothers, the rest?
That was their idea for a joke to put on the poster for the first gig. We had to be called something, so... the Jackson 5 were a reasonably popular band.
Right.
So for the first poster, we were called the Hickson 5. And then it was going to change, and we were going to be the Jimmy Hickson Experience for the next gig. But we ended up just being called the Hicksons, which was probably the most boring name of a band ever. Now, except we were then pipped to the post by the Bloody Smiths.
That's true. Someone told me that they'd met the Edge from U2. Right, so it gets embarrassing if you were like in your 50s and still called your student nickname.
I know.
And they got to him, and this girl was in, I don't know if he had his hat on at the time. The girl said, who's this? And he said, it's the Edge. And she said, what? He said, it's the Edge. She said, what? So she couldn't hear his name. And he went, Dave. Which I think is brilliant. I think that knocks the whole of the YouTube. And of course, Bono has made about $1.5 billion himself from having shares in Facebook.
Has he?
Yeah, he bought like...
I'm pleased for him.
He'll probably give it to the Third World, I imagine.
Yeah.
Or he'll just have his hats flown around in planes. One of the two. That's what he mainly spends his money. And he had the story about Bono, which I hope is true, is that he forgot his hat for one of his concerts and had it flown in a private jet to the concert.
Well, you see, that's why he's a big, famous pop star, and I'm not.
Yeah.
Because to be a pop star, and to you have to believe that you are God.
Yeah.
Because audiences don't want to turn up and see, oh, look, there's Charlie Higson. They want to turn up and say, look, it's Bono! Or Switch. I mean, it never quite worked with Switch. They want to see this godlike figure who's there on stage, and you want to adore this person, and as a pop star, you've got to do that. You've got to be unselfconscious about it. You have to utterly believe that you are the most fantastic thing in the world, and I couldn't do that.
Oh, I saw there's a clip of you live gig on YouTube. I saw.
We were entertaining up to you can take it up to a level when you're still playing, you know, clubs and you know the Lyceum and. That kind of level of things where you've still got that connection with the audience,
yeah.
That's fine. You can be self-deprecating and have a laugh, and we like your warm-up tonight. You can individually say hello to all the members of the audience. And they won't act. But you couldn't do that if you were playing to a million people.
Well,
10,000 people, should we say.
I was playing the Hammersmith Apollo last night, I'll have you know, for 8 minutes. It was fucking
amazing. Yeah, you know, it's the same. It was exactly the same with a comedian. You've got to go out there and go, bang! Look at me. This is what you've come to see. I'm going to be really funny. I'm going to sing amazingly, and the audience want that. And any kind of crack in the armour, and it doesn't work.
No. So you had to give you kind of did you give that up?
I knew that I wasn't going to do it forever. That it wasn't for me. We had a fantastic time. It's a great thing to do as a young person. To be with a bunch of mates, just travel around.
Yeah.
We went all around the world. We had 3 American tours. And we did what we wanted. We had a fantastic laugh, and you get free beer and sandwiches. But you make no money at it. Everybody says these days, oh, the music business, you can't make any money anymore. It was only a tiny, tiny percentage of people at the top who ever made that money.
Yeah.
Most people in the music business make nothing. In fact, most people in the music business end up owing money.
Yeah.
Because you get flown around in jets, you get flown around the world to make these amazing videos, and then you realise that you're paying for it all.
Yeah, and you've got your hat in a different plane. Yeah. Why did I do that? Why did I finally just take the hat with me?
Yeah,
I could have had it.
Never. And, you know, I've got a friend who's in quite a big band, and the band broke up, and that was the end of the thing, and he said, well, I'm going to move on and become solo. And the radio and the record company said, will you owe us £1 million?
Right.
That's the music business. But no, I knew I didn't want to do it forever. I loved doing it, but I'd reached a point where I thought, we're not going to get any bigger, and I can't see myself doing this at 52.
No. It's probably... you've kind of gone and diversified and done all sorts of things. You were at University of East Anglia, not
the Ooh. Thames Valley Polytechnic.
No, it was a real university.
Yeah, real university. And there's a lot of comedians have come out there. Arthur Smith, my wife.
That's two.
Right. So that's with Paul Whitehouse.
Was Paul Whitehouse, yes.
You? So
yes,
good. Yes. So you met there, and so this story I've heard a few times that you got into comedy via plastering Stephen Fry's house. Would that be true, or is that a
not? Well, no, that did happen. I mean, I met Paul at university, and through two other friends, I met Vic Reeves and Harry Enfield. They weren't at that university, but they had friends at university. Yeah. So, you know, as with everything else, it's who you know. But I had no idea that I would end up doing comedy. Back then, this was being the sort of 70s, if you wanted to get on stage and entertain your mates, you formed a band. Mm-hmm. As you got into the 80s and alternative comedy, then going into comedy became an option. Unless you were at Oxford or Cambridge, you could go into Footlights. But the idea at university that you might become a comedian was way off. It was in a pop group. And then the bass player and myself, we started doing some decorating when we weren't on the road, just to make a bit of money, just so we could buy food and clothes for things. And we reached a point where we thought, actually, if we just stuck with the decorating and not the band on the head, we could make a good living, because, you know, there's a lot of houses in London, they all need decorating. So that was the end of the band, and we started a very successful decorating business. And Paul, in the meantime, had worked at Hackney Council and then became a plasterer. He was working in the same line of business, so we did a lot of jobs together. And Harry Enfield, we were all sort of living in the same squat in Hackney. And Harry was doing bits of comedy. He got to know Stephen and Hugh, who'd bought themselves this big house together in Dalston.
That's very sweet. But they bought a house together.
Well, they did, because, you know, they didn't quite have enough to buy their own houses. Right. And they needed some decorating. And Harry said, well, you know, Charlie and Paul do decorate. So we went in and we started decorating. We must have been, for them, the kind of decorators from hell, because we knew they were on the telly and we thought we were quite funny. So we would sort of do funny voices and perform funny skits as we were painting the wall, in the hope that they'd say, oh, my goodness, you're extremely funny. Why don't you come on the television and do some comedy? But no, they wanted the house decorated. So we carried on decorating. By the time we finished, because it was a big house, there was a lot of work to do, Stephen had become enormously wealthy from rewriting the lyrics to Me and My Girl.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Taking out all the references to Nick Knock. But it was an extremely racist musical, so they got him in to rewrite it, and he made a fortune out of it. And so he could go and buy his own house, mm-hmm. and Hugh went off and bought his house, and by that time, Paul and I had started writing for Harry, and we made enough money, we bought the house off him.
Right, so you plastered it yourself, and then you were regretting doing a bad job.
Well, at least we did a very good job. At least we knew the decorating was good.
Can you still do plastering now? Because I'm having my house done up at the moment. It's quite expensive. Do you want to do another comedian's house?
Paul can still do plastering. Yeah.
I might get him over. Well, so do you know his rates are for... Well, I don't want him doing like funny characters and stuff.
I wouldn't get him in there.
No. So, but you also did you come up with the idea of loads of money, which was the big was that you and Paul that came up with it?
Well, sort of. Paul came up with the Stavros voice, because Paul works with a guy at Hackney Council who was a great mimic, and he used to do a sort of London Cockney Turkish stroke Greek accent, which Paul started doing, and then Harry started copying Paul and said, oh, can I make this into a character?
Right.
And they did it on Saturday Live. And Harry got me and Paul in to help him write it.
What about the guy who did the voice originally?
I think he still is working.
Does he stay there? But no, I'll stay.
He doesn't want the showbiz lifestyle.
Or any of the money from the adverts and stuff that Stavros...
No, he doesn't want any of that.
Doesn't want any of that.
But actually, he's also... He did quite a lot of voices. In fact, the Ron Manager voice was one of his.
Was
his? Yeah. And also the guy that suit you, sir. But he was a real bloke. He actually worked at Hackney Council.
Right.
This guy. And when Paul were going in the morning, he'd say, good morning, sir. How are you today, sir? You went out with a lady last night, sir. Did you want to, sir? Oh, suit you. Nicked it entirely off this guy at Hackney Council, who's dead, so he won't get any money. But no, Paul was always very good to his chum at the council, and we did used to give him some money off the back of the flash show. But back to loads of money. Oh, gosh. Have you been watching those Parkinson interviews?
No.
Oh, they're great.
Am I, are you saying I'm assuming you're saying that because I'm as good at Parkinson's?
Have you got so good
at interviewing because you've been watching Parkinson's?
Because everybody on there, they'd all come on completely pissed.
Yeah.
And smoking their heads off. Fantastic. Richard Burton got through about 12 packets of cigarettes. And there's always Peter Cook. There's loads of Peter Cook. And droning on about something. And I was quite jealous. I wanted to come on tonight and smoke.
Yeah.
But I don't smoke. It would have been awful.
And we'd have been shut down because it's illegal for us to do that now.
Yeah, so. I could have got one of those toy, as a child. No, loads of money. Well, we're doing this stuff with Harry. But also, when we were working on jobs together, Paul and I, we would pretend to be working class as an act, and we'd pretend to be builders. We were living in Hackney. We knew quite a lot of the guys like this, and that was one of the funny voices we would do around at Stephen Hughes. And Harry, meanwhile, was also trying to develop a character along these lines, and we sort of put our ideas together with his idea. Because in fact, it was a Geordie friend of ours had been on a cross-channel ferry, and they got caught up with a load of Chelsea fans,
right,
who were all on the ferry with them, and these Geordie guys had no money at all, and all the Chelsea fans had these big wads of cash, and they were taunting the Geordie fans, going, "Look at that, hey, you've not seen that before, have you? Loads of money!" And that's where it came from.
Right.
And Harry heard that, and he thought, well, yeah, and we thought, well, that's a nice little line you could use to set the character up. But Harry, you know, he's very focused and he works out what's going to work. He said, no, that's the whole character. He's going to come on and he's just going to do that.
Right.
And it worked. You know, you just keep repeating it and repeating it. But the amazing thing about Loads of Money is the entire kind of screen time that he was on was probably only about 20 minutes.
So it was Saturday Live?
It was Saturday Live. It went out live. He would do 3 or 4 minutes a week and it was over 2 series.
Right.
And that was it. But it became this massive character because it became a sort of figurehead, a representative of the Thatcher society. And she even said in Parliament, "We've been accused of being a loads of money society. Wow. What's wrong with that?" And in fact, I was in a sauna. Not with Margaret Thatcher. We were doing the Fast Show, the first Fast Show tour we did. No, in fact, not the Fast Show, it was a Harry Enfield tour on the back of that. We were on tour and he was doing the characters and I was in the sauna with some businessmen. And I wish it was a funnier anecdote. And that just happened to be where we were. And this guy said to me, he was a businessman. He said, "Well, you know, what are you doing?" I said, "We're doing a tour with Harry Enfield." He didn't know who Harry Enfield was. He didn't know what Saturday Live was. I said, "You know, Loads of Money." And he said, "Oh, I thought that was something that Margaret Thatcher came up with."
But if she'd been on that ferry, if only she'd been there, history could have been very different.
You know, it's good to know that one of your catchphrases is in the Parliamentary records.
It is. Don't think any of ours are. Though, if, Neil Kinnock did us for the moon on a stick once. there we go. But are you still friendly with Harry?
Yeah.
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 How was it? What was it like creating a character that then something you were doing that character and someone took it off and did it and did it
well,
the time that you might?
I mean, you know. I was a decorator at the time.
Yeah.
It was just a laugh, you know. I mean, the great thing about Saturday Live was it was live. And, you know, there's a huge rigmarole around most TV. It takes months to make, and it's a long and occasionally quite a tedious process. This was great. We'd knock about in a week, come up with some funny lines, and Paul and I would go down to the studio on a Friday night, get pissed, sit in the audience, and just see if any of our lines made it into the final show. But because it was live, you could then react to how that was being picked up during the week, and the tabloids got onto it, and the Sun started using it, you know, is this the real Loads of Money? And you could reflect all that in the next week and pay off. So you got this huge sort of snowball thing going. And on the back of that, you know, Paul and I were sort of accepted as established comedy writers.
Mm. Yeah, of course, cool. But then it did turn into sort of a monster, and the people it was mocking, sort of, I suppose, with Margaret Thatcher being the main example, but those kind of guys did start doing it. It's that kind of Al Murray pub landlord kind of.
Well, that always happens, and you can't get cross about it. You know, Paul and I would have been happy for Harry to carry on doing the character for years.
Yeah,
but he'd had enough of it.
Right,
he wanted to kill it off.
So you kind of did stuff with Jonathan Ross and Vic and Bob, and then you kind of. got into doing your own obviously the Far Show, which is kind of is an interesting for me, because we were doing Fist of Fun at the same time as doing the Far Show. In fact, we were starting up almost at exactly the same time. I think you were a little bit ahead of us. It's kind of been Fist of Fun, which is now out on DVD. You can get that from Go Fast. I don't know if they ever brought the Far Show out. I don't think it was successful enough. The thing is, Fist of Fun, they wouldn't bring it out because they said it was too funny to bring it out on DVD. We'd let the other shows up. I remember actually our producer sitting in an office as we were writing the first series of Fist of Fun and coming up quite gleefully going, the Fast Show did their first show today, and the whole, no one in the audience laughed at anything, everyone just stared at them and it was terrible. And she was very delighted because she thought that meant you were going to fail and we were going to succeed. Didn't work out that way.
Do you remember the recording the first series? Nobody knew what the show was, nobody knew any of us. Well, I mean, Paul had done some stuff with Harry by that point, but you know, they didn't know the characters. Mm. I mean, the thing about doing catchphrase comedy, the important thing to remember is that a catchphrase in itself is not funny. It's just some words.
Yeah.
But this weird thing happens if you just keep repeating it. People start to find it funny, and it's a very, very odd phenomenon. There's nothing inherently funny about saying "suit you, sir." A lot of people say that there is nothing, still isn't anything funny about saying it. But if you keep saying it, it's like a sort of Pavlovian thing, that you're hitting these triggers and people wait for it and you say it and they really, really laugh.
Yeah, if you get the right thing, I think that is true.
I think there's a challenge there. I think you could select any phrase and say, right, we're going to say this enough times that whenever anyone says it in the future, everyone will laugh.
Funnily enough.
Except for that, you picked on the one thing that didn't work. I do remember those early records, and you know, it's quite funny. I mean, the Ted and Ralph characters, which have become probably the most popular characters off the show, we almost didn't put them in the final when the series went out after doing the edit, because we would show them to audiences and they wouldn't laugh at all. Because they'd never seen these characters, but we didn't know what's going on. You could see that they were sort of interested in it on a sort of dramatic level. But if you look at we didn't tart up the studio recordings and add a load of laughter. And it, actually, if you look at the first series, you can hear one person really laughing during the Ted and Ralph sketches, which is Graham Linehan. who wrote the sketches. You can hear it back. And there did come a point, because you know, when Paul and I, we ended up producing the show, we hadn't intended to, but so we were writing it, we were in it, we were producing it, so we were involved in every stage of the process, and it becomes this, you know, it really takes over your life, and you're in the final edit and you're arguing over half a second here and half a second there to try and get this thing down to the length of the edit, and you lose all kind of perspective and objective views. Yeah. And we watched one of these, it was one of the later Ted and Ralph sketches, which is where they're fixing a tractor and Ralph accidentally touches Ted's hand and they both flinch and go very quiet. And we looked at this sketch and then we looked at each other and we thought, we can't put this in. This isn't funny. But we thought, well, we'll give it a go. And we put it out and, you know, the rest is history.
Well, I think the interesting thing about that sketch, because it was sort of different in tone than a lot of the other stuff, I suppose, in the
first. Well, it wasn't fast for a start. Well, it wasn't fast. It was very slow.
Yeah. But it sort of stands out. It is a really clever thing to have done, even if it was accidentally.
It was thanks to Graham Linehan and Arthur Matthews who came up with the character. I mean, they came in quite late. We'd written most of the stuff for the series. They'd written some other stuff for us. We were in the pub with them, and we said to them, you know, have you got any other ideas? And they said, well, we got this one idea for a sketch, we're not quite sure of it. And they acted it out, two of them, which is why Paul's character ended up Irish, because that's how they did it, because they're Irish. And they kind of acted it out, and we just thought, there's something, you know.
Yeah.
They did it was it was the first sketch we put out, I think, where they had this long conversation about mending a fence or something, and then Ralph says, do you like Tina Turner, Ted?
where he's ruined all that stuff. It's just, you know, she's doing a concert and I just wondered. And they acted this out in the pub and we just thought, I don't know why, but there's something very, very funny and touching about it.
Yeah.
And that's why we went with it. But I mean, I think what people picked up on it is that there is an emotional core to it. And we tried to do that in all the Fast Show stuff. You couldn't do it. Suit You, you couldn't really go beyond the fact that they're just two people in a shop who are rude to people. They have, you can't imagine them outside the shop. They have no life, no emotion. And that's why those sketches become the hardest ones to write, because you've got nothing except just the lines. Mm. Whereas Ted and Ralph, you've got a whole world and all those emotions. And, you know, I just played it as I was as an awkward teenager going to discos trying to chat up girls and being hopeless at it.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. It's about all our awkwardness that we all feel. And we tried as far as possible through the Fast Show to make it like that. I'm not a big fan of kind of just cruel, nasty comedy, which is, look at these gits, let's laugh at them and give them a good kicking. Even a character like Colin Hunt, who is an odious office bore, I wanted to make him real and see the kind of sadness behind that facade. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Fast Show is still quite fondly remembered.
I think so, but it also, seriously, looking back at Fist of Fun, which we've had to do to bring them out, and especially the second series of Fist of Fun, where we had to change everything, the BBC made us change stuff, but you kind of can really see that we're stuck in an old-fashioned genre almost of trying to do long sketches and different sketches every week, and it seems enormously old-fashioned because the Fast Show actually did completely change the landscape, and everyone then started doing, you know, this, you know, catchphrase-based, very quick kind of sketches, not always to massive success, as we said, but, you know, so you did sort of redefine the whole genre, and it's interesting to me to see that. I mean, when you could really see the flaws in Fist of Fun in the second series. It is coming out on DVD. Don't still buy it, there's still some good things in there, but it is, you know, it was amazing to see it, I think, like 15 years on, and see how much the landscape had changed. Do you feel proud that that's changed, that you've changed? Sorry, someone just blew their nose because those us, which is, you know, maybe an indication of
the question. It's interesting because often if a show is, you know, he's doing something, we weren't doing anything that new because we were all fans of Dick Emery, who came on every week and did the same characters and with the same catchphrases. But whereas he would have maybe four sketches in an episode, we had like 30.
Yeah.
That was the only difference, really. And that purely came out of the fact that we were a little bit bored and tired of that whole, the sort of two Ronnie style long setup for a sketch, which is you've got to establish who all these people are and where they are and what they're doing and blah-de blah-de blah, and you're trying to work out, I get it, that's going to be the joke at the end, and you're usually there a minute before the sketch ends. We sort of said, well, it's not about the punchline, it's not where you build up to, it's about wanting to see those same characters each week, see what they're doing, and, you know, some characters like Jesse's diets or whatever, it is just his catchphrase and nothing else. And, you know, again, why is that funny, you know? This week, I have been mostly eating yogurt. It's very funny, I don't know why. But again, Ted and Ralph, they didn't really have a catchphrase, but people wanted to see them. But, yeah, it was the speed of it that I suppose it was that changed anything. But again, if you do something like that, you then get someone else making a sketch show, and a lot of times they'll say, well, we can't do it like that because it's going to be too much like the Fast Show.
I guess.
So it's like, we've got to do something completely different. I mean, there were a couple of shows that were pretty similar, but only in the way that we...
If you watch Fist of Fun again, which I don't think you will... You'll be
Is it on DVD?
Why didn't we make that shorter? Why didn't we do that great? This thing, you know, you look at the driving instructor sketch and it'll be like 10 minutes long. You think, we could have just broken that into 10 bits and put it in every week and it would have been much better.
That's another thing we hit on. If we did have a big, long sketch...
Yeah.
You just put in 30 seconds a week. Yeah, yeah. These quick, fast sketches. No, you're just watching one long sketch for 6 weeks.
Why is Swiss Tony spelled T-O-N-I? Why?
You have to ask Vic Reeves that, because he first appeared on Smell of Reason Mortimer.
Right.
They had written a sketch for their two northerners who wear bras. Or don't wear bras. Who knows whether they really are wearing bras, but are obsessed that everyone's looking at their bras. The bra men, as they're called. And they'd written this sketch where they go to buy a car. And in those days, Vic used to write they used to write these amazing scripts. Reading most TV scripts is very dull, but their scripts were fantastically entertaining. Huge, great, thick things. Incredibly long descriptions of the action that was taking place, and also these amazing drawings. I mean, Vic, if you've seen any of his paintings and his books, he does these fantastic paintings and drawings. Yeah. And he would draw all the characters, and he would illustrate all this stuff. Often, he'd get into big problems because he would sort of draw a character and he would put in very pedantic kind of measurements, like the quiff. The quiff, and he would say 4.7 inches. And he would do that just because he was an idiot. But then I, as the producer, would have to deal with all these people from the wardrobe department and the props department saying, look, I've been trying to make this quiff. I can get it to 3 inches, but I'm really... I said, just look, he doesn't know what he made up that measurement. Just make a stupid quiff. But he'd drawn this fantastic drawing of this character, Swiss Tony, right, with an eye, who's his car salesman. And he looks pretty well how Swiss Tony looks. There were a few changes. I think he had plastic bags tied over his feet instead of shoes. We changed that a bit. But we did the sketch, and it was just... I was just there to feed lines to them, really. But afterwards, Bob got obsessed with it, because as we were doing it, we were mucking about off camera, and Bob was coming. Bob is the most filthy man you'll ever meet. He's got an extraordinarily grubby brain and lifestyle. It's him that writes all the really, really filthy Swiss Tony stuff. I can't come up with it myself. It's beyond me. But when we weren't filming, he was doing all these lines. Oh, making love. Driving a caravan is very much... I can't do it. The problem is, because I'm not Bob, I can't do it off the cuff. But he was coming and he kept saying, oh, you must do this character again. And I kept saying to Paul, well, do this character. He said, oh, car salesman is a bit old-fashioned, don't do that. Not very funny. Eventually, third series, I persuaded Paul to let me have a go at it. And the rest is history.
It'd be good if it was literally history, all of these things. Yes. In 500 years' time, we'll open a history book and it'll just all be about the various fashion characters. We'll have to know nothing about David Cameron or Tony Blair starting wars. I hope that will happen.
I sometimes think, when archaeologists, they try and recreate some society, some ancient 4,000 BC society, from a few fragments of pottery and some scraps of poetry. And from that, they're trying to extrapolate out this whole civilization. But, you don't know how representative these things have survived. No. It's entirely random what makes it through. So, yes, it could be.
If only Vic Reeves' scripts make it through.
The only artifact that survives from the last century is one of his scripts. They'd be saying, it's interesting that their quiffs were 4.7 inches long.
Now, I'm asking all of my guests this question that I forgot to ask Jonathan Rossett. Have you ever tried to suck your own cock?
No.
No? That's interesting. Set back, 69% of men have attempted.
No, they haven't.
According to my question, why not? Something to do, isn't it? I mean, as a young man, I think maybe most of them probably do. Probably have done.
No, I have never once in my life thought, well, I'd be really good to suck.
Well, good, it's just an interesting thing to know.
I mean, can't you get other people to do that for you?
Well, not when I was 14, I couldn't. Pretty much. It's been quite difficult.
I expect you could have done if you hung out in the right park.
Actually, I did once have, when I was hitchhiking around Europe, I was hitchhiking around Europe and I was meant to meet my friend Jeff Quigley at Calais, but his ferry, we used to go in boats to the continent, got delayed and we didn't meet up. And then we had this kind of rough plan, we'd meet up in Nice if anything had gone wrong for some reason. And so I'd gone to this youth hostel in Nice, and I was trying to get to the station, and then I was at a roundabout and this car pulled up and I thought, oh, maybe this man will help me. And he said, and I was like an 18-year-old virgin, very naive country boy having grown up in Somerset. And then he just pointed at my cock and then pointed at his mouth. And I was a bit scared and ran away. That was my first opportunity. I mean, if I'd known, I'd waited 18 years, at least he was...
Instead you said to him, no, it's all right, I'll do it myself.
I can just get the ending. It's fine. I mean, it's quite nice of him in a way. It wasn't like pointing at his own cock and then pointing at my mouth. It was kind of for a predatory homosexual man in a car. He was at least quite a sensitive guy. I mean, it was quite nice. I wish I could meet him again now and just thank him. And that was. I didn't want to do it, but it was kind of you to think of it that way around.
Oh, fair enough. I'll take you there anyway. But I'm not going to be able to tweet about this podcast or publicise it because I'm now a respected children's
writer. No, you better not.
I'm very careful what I say.
You do. Well, talking of that, very good segue away from. I'm just asking everyone that. You didn't have to answer.
It was polite.
It was polite to us. My mother told me to wait if a man asked me if you ever tried to suck your own cock, at least answer him honestly. He definitely had. Do you think Jonathan Ross has ever tried to suck his own cock?
I imagine his is huge.
Yeah, that's what I imagine too.
I imagine.
So is it the fact that you know your penis is too small to get into your mouth that has made you not want to do that?
I'm not very flexible. I've got a very straight and stiff back.
Even so, that's what I say. So you have moved into. You were writing quite full on before you were writing the children's books that you do right now. You were writing quite full on graphically unpleasant sort of thrillers things.
Yeah, I wrote four very horrible books in the early 90s. So adult crime books.
Yeah.
Where people do appalling things.
So that's worse than just
it's the one thing that, you know, I can say because it's like if you're in a royal family.
Yeah.
You're brought up to behave in a certain way and be a member of royalty. When I was a kid, I never expected I would grow up to be a children's writer. When I was a teenager, when I was in a band, it was sex and drugs and rock and roll. And that's what you do. And I wrote these horrible books. And never expecting that one day I'd have to go out and be an ambassador for children's books. And go into schools where you're very heavily vetted. But so the one thing I can say is, look, well, Lemon, I did write these books before. You know, I have a history. Your Honour, I'd like these books to be taken into consideration. But yes, I did write these quite nasty books.
Mm. But then Roald Dahl wrote very sexually explicit and unpleasant books as well as.
Yeah, actually, I was. I don't know if you must. You probably know. You know how Anthony Horowitz is? People in the audience. He wrote the Alex Rider kids books, but he also does a huge amount of TV.
Yeah.
Things like Midsummer Murders and Touch of Frost. Foyle's War.
Ah, yes, that's what Foyle.
And so we've had quite a similar, working life. But he started writing kids' books many, many years ago. I don't know whether you might not be able to use this bit. But he said when he first did a tour of schools, he found himself following in the footsteps of Roald Dahl.
Yeah.
Who seemed to have gone to a lot of the same schools that he was going into. And Anthony said every time he turned up at school, the headmaster would take him to one side and said, "Oh, Mr. Horowitz, great that you could come to our school and talk to John, but you're not going to be like Roald Dahl, are you?" Because apparently he was appalling.
Really?
I mean, he notoriously hated children anyway, but he would go into these schools and he was rude, he would make inappropriate comments about little girls' knickers, and he was quite... The kids probably loved it.
Yeah.
But these teachers are going, "Oh, my God." And now these days, you'd be arrested. But those days, you could do what you like.
Well, as long as you hate kids, it's all right. I think it's if you like them too much that you're really in trouble. I really fucking hate you. That's okay, that's fine. Please come into our school. But you have me. So were the young James Bond books the first move into writing?
Yeah, I was approached completely out of the blue by, in fact, my ex-editor who I'd worked with on the adult books. She was working for the Ian Fleming estate and they were looking for a writer to do these young Bond books. She knew I was a huge James Bond fan. She knew I had three boys. And she thought my writing style would work for children.
Right.
And they gave me the job, which was fantastic. You know, to actually write a real James Bond book is just so exciting for someone who grew up in the 60s like me. James Bond was the biggest thing in the world. To sit down and write the words, "The name's Bond, James Bond," is just... I mean, I just thought this is something.
You had to do more than that, right? That wasn't...
No, that's all the first point was. But no, yeah, but you know, you're writing a real James Bond book about James Bond, yeah. You know, and I got sort of privileged access to the world of James Bond and Ian Fleming's family, and it was just the most amazing thing to do.
Did you have any reservations about taking that on? Because that often, I mean, it's a little bit different than writing a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. No, I'm going to write the next thing of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I would say it's quite a big step.
I know, I mean, we see, when they came to me and presented me the idea, I just thought, wow, that'd be brilliant fun. And I sort of quite quickly got an idea of how the book would work, and I thought my kids would love this. I thought, yeah, fantastic. And I wrote this book. And it was only when I'd finished it, because it wasn't announced till after I'd finished it, in case they didn't like it, in which case no one would have ever heard about it. Once they were happy with it and they made the announcement, it was at that point I suddenly thought, oh my God, I've written a James Bond book. This is quite a big thing to take on, and people have very strong ideas about it. And they did. I mean, the internet sites went bonkers. Who is this English comedian writing these bloody... We don't want a Harry Potter-style James Bond with him. Oh, I'll have a glass of milkshake and not stirred. And he's homeworking late. They were incensed. And I would have been the same if I'd heard Richard Herring is writing some James Bond books. Fuck off. I would have been exactly the same. But luckily, you know, and at that point I thought, oh, Christ, this could go very badly wrong. But luckily, when the book came out, the fans did like it, because they could see that, you know, I came from a point of view of being a massive Ian Fleming fan, and it was, you know, it was an homage to Fleming. And I won them round, and the fans do like the books.
I've had an idea for James Bond, really old James Bond, right? And it's him like in a nursing home, and it just is the stuff he's doing. He goes, the name's. If you want to write them, go ahead.
You're not very good at coming up with commercial ideas.
About him trying to go to the toilet, that'd be one of the books.
Yeah, a lot of people are really going to read that.
Well, you know, just they could flirt a bit with the, you know, the nurses and stuff. I haven't thought it all the way through. You know, because you've done five of the young ones, and then he grows up, doesn't he? Then he grows up, you can't do it. Then the problem you've made there is they grow up. Then Ian Fleming's covered the next bit.
Well, I know.
What I'm saying is there's maybe James Bond in the afterlife.
One of the tricky things I was faced with, because Ian Fleming wrote, all you know, over the course of 12, 13 years, he wrote the James Bond books, and he tried to keep James Bond at the same age, roughly 35,
right,
over the course of 15 years, which means his backstory keeps sliding all over the place. So when I was faced with the task of kind of working out what happened when and how old he was, a lot of things made no sense at all. So right. I had to kind of fudge quite a bit.
Yeah, bloody Ian Fleming, eh?
Well, he had no idea. You know, he was making up as he went along. He had no idea. He thought this might work. You know, he wrote the first one. It was popular. He wrote some more. He had no idea that 60 years later, James Bond would still be the kind of one of the best known fictional characters in the world, and you know, these films are still making vast amounts of money. People are doing, you know, do university courses studying James Bond, and he had no idea of that. And you know, he would write a book and forget about it, and the facts don't tally up from one book to another. I mean, it's all over the place. He had no idea there'd be the internet and people would be pouring over this stuff and saying, well, this happened here, and studying and going back and studying the manuscripts. He was just having a laugh.
Did you go on internet forums and pretend to be one of these? I read somewhere that you were going on and joining in the conversations under a...
Yeah, I called myself Sylvia Tench, who is the girl in the first Bond film.
Oh, right.
The first girl that he enjoys.
Right.
He comes back to the hotel room and she's standing there wearing just his shirt.
Right.
Very, very alluring scene. And she turned up in the second film as well. Mm. The same character. So I was Sylvia Tench, and I still am. I can still go on there.
Do
as
you?
Sylvia Tench.
It's good. I don't think I've ever gone on, I've always been myself, but it's quite a nice idea of going on and joining it. Did you just criticise yourself, or did you stick
up
for yourself?
Well, I get involved in conversation with people, you know. The great thing was, when it was first announced, James Bond appeals to the male collector instinct. There are people out there who, if it's James Bond, they've got to have it.
Yeah.
They'll have all the films on original VHS, and then the redesigned VHSs, and then the DVD, yeah, and the Blu-ray, and they'll have everything, and they'll have every book. And it's fantastic. You know, men and boys love that. They like to see a shelf. Look at that. That's the entire James Bond film set, and that's it in DVD. And so they would say, I am appalled by this idea of this idiot writing these James Bond books. I will, of course, buy them so that I've got the full set on my shelves. I thought, I don't care. You don't have to read them, just buy them. That's fine with me.
You can buy them, buy one set just to burn and rip up and jump up and down. I bet they'll have one good set as well. Well, that's good, Ewan. That's a good thing. And now you're writing books about zombies.
Yeah.
You were at school or something. I've got this from the paper today, I think.
All right.
A child said to you, I don't mean to be rude, yeah, but don't you think you could have done more with your life than writing about zombies?
I do.
Which is a good question.
It is a fantastic question. I do a lot of schools visits, and that's the best question I've ever been asked. It was last year, and he said, you can have done more with your life than writing stories about zombies. And I stopped and I thought, oh, he's right, isn't he? I was sort of taken aback. I thought, what a waste of a life. And I thought, no, I've enjoyed, but I've had a fantastic life as a writer. And I have. I've really enjoyed everything I've done. And I've loved writing books. I've loved making TV and, you know, being able to be your own boss, right? But, and, you know, I still get to travel around the world because the books are published everywhere. And I sort of rallied and I thought, well, I'll try and fight my cause here. I don't think I won him over.
No.
But it's a fantastic question if you're ever at a literary event. You go to the Hay Festival, whoever it is, you can rephrase it. You know, Hilary Mantel. Hilary, I don't mean to be rude. Don't you think you could have done more with your life than write stories about some dead bloke who was around in Henry VIII's time? I've had 5 years or so I should be working on it. And yes, writing is a complete waste of one's life.
She said, I've had a number 62 hit in the brain. Fuck you. I can see your knickers.
I remember when I was a kid, and I was a young teenager, and I loved reading. I was a very kind of bookish boy. I read this interview with Steve McQueen.
Yes.
And, you know, at the time this was, you know, Steve McQueen with his motorbike. And he said, I've never read a book in my life. And I thought, oh, God, that's such a shame. You know, poor Steve McQueen. What a waste of his life. He's never read a book. And then I thought, this is Steve McQueen! He's done everything that we read about in books. He's actually gone out there and done it. Who does he want to waste his time reading books for?
My friend Al's daughter, who's about 10 now, I think, maybe perhaps a bit older than that, I'm writing a column in the Metro at the moment every week, and she went, who would want to read about just the stuff he's doing? I'm going to go, yeah, good point.
Everything we do is based on self-confidence and self-belief. If you let that slip for a moment, everything you do in your life becomes dust. Mm. And you know, as a writer, that you know, you've got to really think very highly of yourself, and just have that confidence to say, no, someone will want to read this book.
So is it just me though? Is it only me? I was discussing earlier the fact that I can remember these arguments I had when I was 8 years old with people that I still remember. Do you remember anything like that from when you were 8?
Nothing.
You let those things go.
My long-term memory is shot to pieces. I remember nothing.
Do you think that's weird that I still...
No, a lot of people
still
do.
Brewing,
but these things obviously rankle.
They do. Well, no, especially when I'm right. I like to be right.
Well, you were right.
Yeah. Do you think I was right about the one when I was... They're definitely about that.
Yeah.
But what about the one about me being fatter than my friend and that would mean I would die first? And
well, that's a scientific... You know, it's a long discussion.
Surely, I mean, I'd live longer with the fat reserves. I'd be hungry, but I would... Surely... I just hate the idea that Phil Fry might be right.
He said he was probably a lot fitter than you.
We had a bet for 10p
so
about it.
So he could chase a pig down.
Well, it wasn't about that. It was just about nothing. And we bet each other 10p, and I think I won the bet, and he never coughed up the 10p, and that's what that
means. You can only win the bet by actually surviving him on the desert island.
We could do it now.
For 10p, it's worth it.
I suppose one of us could eat the other one. But then that's... or just ourselves.
Well, actually, he'd live a lot longer.
And you're a big quizzer. I've been on the
Monday night. I should be there.
I'm hopefully going to get if we go on long enough, which we seem to be doing. We've done a long time actually.
Have we watched it long?
No, I wanted that. That's up for the people listening and turning off the podcast at home to decide. And the people, so there is a lot of people asleep. I think they may be.
They may download it, Richard, but do they listen?
Felicity has sent along some people from the Dream School to just go to sleep during this. They've heard Charlie Hickson's on.
send people to sleep.
No, we're not. I think we're nearly done. It's been quite. You know, I've been a bit of a fanboy and just asked you loads of comedy questions, which hopefully is okay. But you're not very.
Are we going on to the politics bit now?
Yeah, we've Do you think Colin Hunt is the same as the opposite? Ricky Gervais copied you and did Colin Hunt in the
totally,
office?
Totally ripped us off. But we did it more realistically. No, you see, when the funny thing was...
That's different than funny enough is the catchphrase. You can't even do the catchphrase. I don't want to let you out on catchphrase comedy.
You do it two times, then you slightly change it around a bit.
Okay.
And then you bring it in... for the big payoff. Cool. No, funnily enough. See?
Yeah.
We'd been rehearsing Colin Hunt in the rehearsal rooms, as you do, without makeup or wigs or anything. And the first day on set, when we're actually there in front of the audience, the first time I turn up with the full wig and costume, and I walked on set, and the rest of the Fast Show team, you could see their faces drop. Okay. What are you doing, Charlie? We thought you were just going to come on... as yourself. Why are you dressed in that ridiculous clownish outfit? I said, no, it's important for the character, you know, it helps me. And, you know, but maybe they were right. Maybe he didn't need all those accoutrements. Because, you know, Ricky Gervais, as I say, he did it enormously realistic. And, you know, it still is, I think, one of the funniest, top five funniest series ever made, I think. But, in fact, I had
Fist
been thinking...
Fist of Funds been... the top three...
I had been thinking of doing a sort of spin-off Colin Hunt sitcom,
right,
where in the first episode he's told he's got terminal cancer, and then it's him trying to joke his way through it.
That man over there doesn't like it. I say, there's a man over there that's going, no, that can't happen. But you know,
but you see, Ricky Gervais beat us to it.
Yeah.
No, the horrible thing is, wouldn't it have been horrible if you rewrite history if we had done a whole sitcom, a Colin Hunt based office based sitcom, and Ricky Gervais had seen it and said, you know, I was going to do a series set in Office, I don't think I will now because it's going to look too much like, and he never did it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that have been awful?
Well, I mean, it would have been a shame if you lost The Office, but think of all the crimes you would have prevented after that. So sometimes you have to travel back in time and kill Hitler. I'm not saying Ricky Gervais is... that what he's done yet is as bad as Hitler. But, you know, Ricky Gervais, we can't judge it because Ricky Gervais isn't yet dead. So when he's dead, we'll then compare the crimes. I mean, at the moment, definitely Hitler is, you know. But I had to choose who was the worst person out of the two at the moment. I have to think about it a bit, but I think almost certainly Hitler. I mean, you have to balance up the good and the bad. So The Office does help Ricky Gervais, not Hitler. Good. I thought this might be an interesting one. I think it's been very interesting.
It's a butt cut.
But, funny enough.
Well, I've had a lovely
you
time.
You had a nice time.
You're flicking through this, but you I'm don't just have to ask me any more.
I just wanted to check
you
and see if there was anything. I know, I'm pretty good, aren't I? Pretty good at reading stuff.
Well, you stayed awake. Which is a plus for me. Best time ever.
But like, this is like an hour and 20 minutes.
God.
I'm really tired. I was doing the Hammersmith Apollo last night. I did the Hammersmith Apollo. I did 8 minutes of stand-up. I was on first and it went pretty well. Do you see it?
Yeah.
And then we came on and we did the Girly Smiley Spam from Fist of Fun for the first time in 70 years. That didn't really work. Didn't really work, did it? No. So it's kind of had the kind of high, because I don't get to perform in the Hammersmith Apollo very much. You know, only in charity gigs. And the charity is give Richard Herring a chance. They pretend it's for a cause. They go, so I feel a bit sorry for Richard Herring. It didn't quite work. Let's then to 8 minutes, and then we did the Girl Smarts. Didn't I think? What do you think went wrong with the Girl Smarts? Man, they just didn't get.
It just wasn't the right place.
Wasn't the right place? Was it just a sketch?
It wasn't. No, exactly. People weren't expecting it.
People weren't expecting a sketch. Do you think they thought it was serious to begin with, and then because that's what we were going for?
It was a bit weird.
You're all right. Fuck off, who idiots? Fucking hell! All right, lay off. We gave it for charity. Didn't quite work, but it was nice to have the old Rich Hanger's fat team back together. me, Sally Phillips and Kevin Eldon, the actor Kevin Eldon, was playing Stuart Lee.
Yeah. Yeah, man, if you have to choose between him and Hitler, that's much easier. So I think we'll move on to the competition. We're going to give some, because we'll see. We're going to do a quiz show. We're going to find out if you've won your quiz, if people have won your quiz without you, hopefully. Right. Hopefully during this, and that might be one of the questions. This is what you're going to win. You can win Ted and Ralph. We were talking about it. The whole... I might actually just nick that.
That's the actual whole 15-minute
is it?
Film.
Yeah. Plus all the sketches. And all the sketches.
Yeah.
Yeah, that might go missing.
It's a really good film, that.
I might have that. Bellamy's People. Is there another series of Bellamy's People in the pipeline?
No. That's Bellamy's People, the unsuccessful comedy that we did after everything else.
Well, compared to anything I've done, it's still way more successful. So there you go. It's all comparative. The audiobook of Where Did It Go Right, which is currently used by Ballast as from Go Faster Stripe to balance up things that when they send me boxes that don't have enough DVDs to fill the boxes. I've got about 20 of these. Cost £5, I think, at Go Faster Stripe now, if you want to get that. There's loads of good things at Go Faster Stripe. And Andrew Collins' book, Where Did It Go Right? Hey, we were talking about Fist of Fun, and I've got a Fist of Fun as well. Oh. Fist of Fun, first series of Fist of
What's
Fun.
That, the DVD?
DVD. Oh, the most exciting thing is inside the book. I've got we just brought out the book Talking Cock, which we bought from Go Faster Stripe in a similar way to Fist of Fun, except we've printed up 3,000 of these and we sold 50 so far. So, so it'd be nice if you want to read the book Talking Cock, my first book, you can only get it from Go Faster Stripe. But the exciting thing, this is unexciting, my backstage access all areas pass from the House of Apollo last night, signed by me. That is literally... And, excitingly, the Charlie... I've forgotten his name.
Brooker.
Charlie... I don't want to call him Charlie Higson, because that would be a mistake. It doesn't have it written on here, so Charlie Brooker. I knew. I was playing a clever joke. Charlie Brooker's on next week. That's sold out, that one. I don't know why I'm looking at you. I don't know why I'm looking at you, Charlie, because I'm in all of these. It's more of a comment on me. I'm in all of them.
You know, between us, Richard, we've got, I think, 140,000 followers on Twitter.
Yeah.
We've both of us been tweeting for years. And I was saying, right, let's see how effective Twitter is. Because I looked at the, you could look and there was a seating plan. What seats are still available? And I looked at that and I thought, well, there's quite a few seats still available.
There are.
I'll tweet about this. And I'd check after I'd done this tweeting, what difference it made. And then you were tweeting, and then we've got a lot of people tweeting.
Yeah.
Made not a single extra sale.
I was looking this afternoon. The number actually went up. The number of tickets left when it was on 265, and then it went up back up to 270. So I don't know if they just found four more or someone went, oh no.
But that's
I thought it was Charlie Brooker this week. I'll give those back. Anyway, win two tickets to see Charlie Brooker next week. That's a pretty good prize. And of course, the sponsor of this podcast, you may have Foster's sponsoring you for loads of money. I've got Elliot Lyne, who gives me nothing but some copies of his very clever puzzle compendium, Volume 1. I think he should have left the Volume 1 off. And just, if there was a second volume, he could have called it Volume 2. Which he's given me no details. It's like Mensa quality puzzles. He doesn't pay me for this. He's given me no details of where you can get this. But I thought this week, you know, if you can't work out where to get it, you're probably not going to be able to do the puzzles anyway. So the first puzzle is if you can find out how to buy it, you're probably already a genius. So that might get him a few sales. But he just came to a gig and gave me a plastic bag with 10 of these in it. So I thought, I'll give these away. And he's our main sponsor. I should have thanked him in the credits. I haven't tried to do any of them yet, but... Yeah, that looks complicated, doesn't it? So you can win all of these things, and
you're all signed.
It's going to be signed. Oh no, I thought you were going to sign the LA lines. No. That would make that very valuable. It's a book of this that is not in the LA lines house. So anyway, what we're going to do, you can win this, and we're going to ask you, so we're going to make a series of statements that are either true or false.
Christ,
and you have to decide if they're true or false. If you get it right, you can stay in. If you get it wrong, you have to sit down. So we need you all to stand up first of all. We need the lights up a little bit. There's loads more people than I thought, which is kind of worse, actually, than anything. It did sound like there was no one in, and there's fucking hundreds of them. So we're going to make some statements. If you think they're true, put your hands on your head. If you think they're false, put your hands on your bottom. If you get it wrong, self-policing. Anyone cheating, do punch them in the face. You have to sit down because these are proper good prizes. My first true or false fact is during the recording, I was just out in the interval. I checked the BBC News site, and there's been quite a few deaths recently. I don't know, quite shocking deaths. Probably the most shocking of all is during the interval, I discovered that today, 2 hours ago, the newsreader Kenneth Kendall died. Is that true? That's a bit of a downer for the first one. But is that true? Or if you think that's true, put your hands on your head. If you think it's false, put your hands on your bottom. The seat of all falsehood. That is false. I do that every week. So that's 1 week it'll come true, though. So sit down if you said true. I saw a few of you. Have you got a statement of truth or falsehood, Charlie?
Well, after we had decorated Stephen New's house, and we bought it, and Paul and I made enough money to move on, and the house was subsequently bought by the Mighty Boosh.
Ooh, is that true or false? Good one. Good. That's a good thing of truth. I don't know the answer to that from my... From my research, is the answer? What's the answer?
It's bollocks.
It's bollocks. It's Fossey. We've got around loads. Well done. Do you know who did buy it?
Well, the other guy that we bought it with is still there.
Oh, is he still there?
He's called Daryl. I've got quite in the city.
Have you? Yeah, that's good.
Funnily enough,
I've got quite a lot of Froome-based facts I looked up.
Go on.
I thought we'd talk about Froome for a while. It didn't turn out. Froome comes from the old English word fraw, F-R-A-W, meaning dung pile. Is that true or false? Froome comes from the old English word fraw, meaning dung pile. That is false. It comes from the old English word fraw, meaning fair or brisk, which was the river Froome, of course you would know. Have you got another one?
I'll think of one.
Okay, do you want to do another one while we're waiting?
Yes, go. Yeah.
Pee-wee Herman, the disgraced ex-children's US TV presenter, now lives in Froome. Is that true? Is that true or false? And man, if this is true, you fucking won the lot, man. He's already he's sat down already. He's not even waiting for the answer. You can just change your mind. It is false, but Pee-wee Ellis, the US composer and member of the James Brown band, does. Got a similar name.
Oh, here's one then. The most popular breakfast cereal in the UK is Weetabix. True or false?
True or false?
Get to fuck.
Don't help. Get to fuck, a man shouting lion bar. I'm not sure you really want to listen to his judge. And it's not quite Who Wants to Be a Millionaire coughing. A man going, what the fuck? It's a lion bar. It's the most popular cereal. And that doesn't seem to have swung anyone. What's the answer?
It's true.
It's true, wow. It may not be true, but Charlie thinks it's true. Yeah,
the company's just been bought by the Chinese.
Wow.
That's true as well. I wasn't testing them.
All right, here's another one. Edred, King of England, from 944 to 955, died in Froome 1,003 years before Charlie Hickson was born there. Is that true or false? Every element of that has to be true. Approximately 1,003. Oh, man changed his mind when the approximately came in. He thought, that's false. Bad luck, it's true, mate. Should have stuck with your first answer. He died in 955, which if you'd worked it out was 1,003. You can work out how old Charlie Hickson is, isn't it, everyone?
I'm 53.
Let's see if... Have you got another one?
I should have done that as a true or false.
Shit. No, nothing's come through from the quiz, so... They're either celebrating...
They have the answers by now.
They might do. Richard Franch, the pianist from... whose line is anyway? Was born in Froome 1 year after Charlie Hickson was born there. Is that true or false? Couple of trues. Couple of falses. And there's still someone over there when I'm saying false. It is true. So we've got two gentlemen left in. They're two chubbier bearded gentlemen. That's not representative... necessarily of the kind of people who come. One of them doesn't even have a beard and one of them isn't all that fat, so it's not, it's, you know, if you've got a stereotypical idea of the kind of people who come to this podcast, you are way off. Only half of them are bearded. They're both above average weight. Is that true or no?
I got one.
You got one? Go for it.
I've got another one.
This will get him. This will get him. Well, you're going to have to get one of them.
The first line
of my first published novel, King of the Ants, is Fuck Off Nero.
Wow, is that true or false? Have you got up for false at the back? Yeah, so this is the decider. This is very exciting. We'll find out who's going to win. What is the answer?
The first line of my first published novel, King of the Ants, is Fuck Off Caesar.
Oh! The beard goes. So you've won, sir. I will pass them back. I think it's probably the easiest thing to do. I hope no one steals the signed Access All Areas pass for yesterday. If you can travel back in time, you can meet Ben Elton backstage. Yeah. What's your name, sir?
Dan.
What's your last name?
Carpenter.
Dan Carpenter. How are you doing, Dan? Do you come very regularly to the podcast? No, are you just a newcomer, just chanced your way in, won all the stuff? Yeah, you're going to come to see Charlie Brooker next week?
Yeah.
Pretty exciting, isn't it?
It
could
be good.
Two tickets, isn't it?
Because he's going to come, just gave him two tickets.
He might not come, you might just chuck him in the bin. Are you more excited about seeing Charlie Higson or Charlie Brooker, would you say?
Charlie Higson, definitely.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to come back to you next week and ask you the same question. Is that your girlfriend?
No.
Man, I wouldn't say no so hastily. She's... are you just friends?
Just friends.
Aww. Do you want to be more than friends? Because that could be the extra prize I can give you at the end of the podcast.
Sexuality.
Don't question your sexuality. I wasn't questioning it. Don't assume.
Auction it.
Don't auction it. Oh, that's fine. Don't auction my sexuality. Not really. I'm not auctioning your sexuality. I'm just auctioning you. It's not like I'm going, who wants her to be a lesbian, bisexual, the highest bidder? Mark Zuckerman comes in. What's his name? Zuckerberg. It works better if you know the facts. That's the thing. Jokes always work better. I was hoping we'd get a text. That could have been the last question, but it hasn't come through. So Becky Sunshine has let us down. Well, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for coming along. I hope did you enjoy it, everyone? Yeah. All right, it was quite interesting, wasn't it? Did you enjoy it on Thames Valley? Yeah, Thames Valley Polytechnic there in the front row. Yeah, another person who hasn't come with his girlfriend. Thank you very much for coming. If you want to come along, we've got tickets, not for next week, but we have a week off, and then it's Nick Frost and David Baddiel are going to be, we're two people together on, I think it's the 11th of June, and we just had a text through. This is very exciting, this is happening right now. 9 out of 10 on Sports Round, a painful 4 out of 10 for True or False. Overall, we came second. Nardi is team one. Bollocks. They lost by 1 point. And I bet you would have
been there.
You could have made the difference.
We always have to beat Nardi's team. I can't believe she
bloody
beat
Nardia.
From Big Brother.
Is it Nardia from Big Brother?
No, Nardia Shireen, the children's illustrator.
Oh.
I move in slightly higher circles than Nardia.
You were hoping it was Nardia from Big Brother, weren't you?
Yeah.
We'll get her on next week.
I won't be here.
Oh, you won't be here. You won't. I'm not having you in.
You
turned up late. We have sold out. And if you turn up again, I'm going, don't let him in. Old lady. Thames Valley didn't even get his degree. Just gave up. You had to be here for the first half. We might cut that bit out. Never know. Don't know if the Roald Dahl bit made it in. If it didn't, bad luck at home. Should have listened.
Are you ever
going
to stop?
No. I nearly came to a good end. I just suddenly got on a roll, Charlie. Just suddenly I thought, fuck, I might just see how long I go and see how long people will stay. And just people start drifting out one by one. I think he'll stay, though. I think he'll say. So we will wrap it up. Please do listen and tell your friends about this if you've enjoyed it, and please give a massive round of applause to the amazing Charlie Higson. You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, starring Richard Herring with special guest today, Charlie Higson. The music was by Pest. They were good. It's produced by Ben Walker. Lots of thanks as well to Orange Mark and the British Comedy Guide and everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre. This is a Fuzz and Sky Potato production. Hooray! How'd you like them Sky Potatoes? Hello, I hope you've enjoyed Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Rehearsed-a-per.
This is free for you at home, and I hope you appreciate that. If you feel like giving something in return, then it would be lovely if you wanted to come along and watch one of the shows. They're selling fast, but there are tickets available for a couple of them. So go to the Leicester Square Theatre website. Or you could buy tickets to see me doing Talking Cock, my new show, at the Edinburgh Fringe, or Richard Herring's Edinburgh Fringe podcast. You can get those at edfringe.com. My book, Talking Cock, has just been brought out by the good people at gofasterstripe.com, where you can get lots of my merchandise and Andrew Collins' talking book if you want it. We've bought 3,000 copies of Talking Cock. Chris Evans, not that one's done that, so it'd be lovely if you wanted to go to gofasterstripe.com and buy that or any of the other DVDs. If you like the way this is produced, then it's an excellent production. Then why not show your support to the producer, Ben Walker, whose other show, Do the Right Thing, is at the Phoenix on the 29th of May. It's a hard thing to Google because they've chosen the name that's already the name of something else because they're idiots. So go to wegottickets.com and you can find it. Is that right, Ben? Good. Or just if you can't afford to do any of that, it'll be lovely if you just pass the word on to your friends about this podcast. But it's lovely to do it all for free. It'd be nice to make some money too. Help me, please. I've got a kitchen to pay for. Nah, bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.